Welcome to episode 34 of The Mental Breakdown. I'm Dr. Bernie.
And I'm Dr. Richard.
And happy Friday, Richard.
Well, happy Friday.
And here we are. Got a little feedback there. So here we are Friday. We're starting a little bit later than usual. It's not our fault. Dr. Suarez came in. One of our colleagues came in this morning, and we haven't seen her in a few days. And we got to talking and realized that we were running very far behind.
Running a little bit late.
So we apologize for those of you who were hoping and looking forward to listening to us on Mixlr. We're on Mixlr now, but if you're listening to this on the podcast, it doesn't do you any good, I suppose.
Right.
So the title of today's show is Six Children with Inattention.
I'm excited about this podcast.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to this one.
You know, and I think I've been going back and listening to some of our previous podcasts because that's just what I do. And I think we say that at the beginning of every podcast.
That you're looking at the old, listening to the old ones?
No, that I'm excited about the podcast.
Oh, I'm excited about this one. Yes. Right.
I get excited about all of them just because I really enjoy getting this information out there and talking about these things, because I don't think there's enough people talking about these things. So so today, Six Children with Inattention. Now, Richard, where did we come up with this title? Where did this come about?
I can answer that question. Way back, I think in 1961.
Yep, 1961.
That was before you were born, wasn't it?
I heard about a time called 1961.
That feels like history to you, doesn't it?
I read it in a book.
Oh, my gosh. My book didn't go up to, that was no 1961 when I was in school. Anyway, there was this great article written by a pediatrician from England that he used to teach his pediatric residents. And the title of the article, it was published in a journal called The Lancet, L-A-N-C-E-T, which was an old, by old, it goes back into the 1800s, British medical journal, which was one of the premier medical journals in the world at the time. And in 1961, this pediatrician wrote this article called Six Children with Coughs. And the purpose of the article was to teach his residents that just because a child comes in with a cough, the investigation doesn't stop there, because he presented six patients. Each patient had similar symptoms, but the symptoms were, had each child had a different explanation for why he or she was coughing.
Right.
Okay? And so his message to his residents was, don't just stop at the symptoms, figure out why the cough is occurring.
Right.
Because figuring out why the cough, the real cause, the actual cause of the cough, leads to the proper intervention, the proper treatment.
Right. And just to catch people up with the significance of that is that, you know, of course, that was a time when, you know, in the 1950s and 1960s, we had a pretty big explosion in medicine. You know, there, we were coming up with a lot of new medical interventions. And at that time, there were a lot of health-related issues in childhood that were really not fully understood. And so, you know, so he was talking about the importance of getting to that next level of investigation, that somebody just comes in and has a cough, you don't immediately give an inhaler, or you don't immediately, well, I don't even know if they had inhalers
well,
then, but
what he talked about was tuberculosis,
right,
you know, or cystic fibrosis. I mean, in 1961, cystic fibrosis was a terminal illness.
Right.
Okay. So a child comes in with a cough. If the child has tuberculosis, that's one treatment. If a child just has an upper respiratory infection, that's a completely different treatment. And remember, we're talking about treatment in the days when penicillin had only recently been introduced.
Right.
So for these physicians, it was important to know how to handle an infectious disease, whatever it might be, whether it's tuberculosis or influenza, or some other viral or bacterial infection. So in these days, it was important to focus on infectious diseases, because penicillin had just started to really, well, the antibiotics revolution had just begun.
Right. And so today, we have much of that appreciation of some of those medical issues, and physicians do a much better job because we have better assessment tools and assessment procedures to look at some of those things. However, again, kind of driving us to today's podcast, we're still not as good, if that is an appropriate sentence. we still fail to do as adequate of a job when it comes to some behavioral or psychological presentations.
Psychological, developmental, yeah.
Right. So what we're going to do today, how we're going to approach this is very similar to that Lancet article from 1961. And we're going to talk about these six kids. Mm-hmm. And these six kids could be any six kids because over the years of our work, we've seen a kid that could fit into any of these seats. Mm-hmm. But what we're going to do, let's sort of create a mental picture. So let's think about a third grade classroom. In a third grade classroom with a class full of students, 25 or so kids. And in that classroom, there are these six children. And those six children are all inattentive. And what we mean by inattentive is they're not paying full attention. They're looking off, looking out the window. They are not actively engaged in the academic process.
They're easily distracted. They don't finish assignments.
Right.
They don't seem to know what's expected on an assignment.
Right.
Like they're not paying attention to the instructions that the teacher gives.
Exactly. They're always a little bit behind. The teacher will say, get your math book out. And a few minutes later, they will look around and see, oh, everybody else has their math book out. So I'm going to get my math book out. So this is a very common picture that we see with kids with inattention in a classroom. Their reading isn't very good because they have poor reading comprehension, either because they're reading too slow. And I guess at some point we should talk about reading in a podcast, I guess. That would be fun.
Put it on the list.
Yeah. So their reading comprehension is poor. They're not doing very well on tests. Yeah, they're just not engaged
I
completely think in the academic process.
Right. You can just tell. A teacher has this sense that some children are just not engaged in the tasks that he or she, that the teacher wants them to do.
Right.
And you can see it. You can tell. Some are distractible. Some don't complete assignments. Some don't know what's expected of them. Some, they don't follow the directions. But teachers just have this sixth sense about who's not paying attention.
Right.
Right. And that's what they bring. That's what they say to parents.
Right.
You know, I wonder about your child's attention. You know, you have those parent-teacher conferences.
Right.
And the teacher says, she just doesn't seem to be completely engaged.
Right. And that, of course, is the next step, is that the teacher recognizes some of these issues, recognizes perhaps that the kid's not paying attention very well, and will say something to the parent. Mention to the parent that, hey, you know, little Susie or little Tommy isn't paying attention very well in class. I notice him to be off task a lot. Mm-hmm. He's not getting his work done. What do you see at home? You know, the teacher will then sort of explore to see if what she's seeing in the classroom is similar or dissimilar from what the parents see at home. Mm-hmm. A normal process. And depending on how the parent responds, you know, in our scenario, what then is going to happen is that the parent is going to say, let's go talk to the pediatrician because the kid's not paying attention. Or let's talk to the school psychologist, or let's talk to the guidance counselor at school. Let's see if we can investigate this a little bit more.
That's right. And as a little aside here, we were talking about the original Lancet article about the coughs, you know, because in those years, it was important for physicians to know how to deal with infectious diseases. That was in the 1961 that article came out. So it was written in the late 50s, probably.
Right.
Okay. Well, by the 1970s, a wonderful pediatrician by the name of Mel Levine was writing articles and teaching his residents that we have just about conquered infectious diseases, but now what you have to learn how to treat, what he taught his students how to treat, were developmental issues.
Right.
Because now parents are bringing their children to pediatricians. By the 1970s, it's not just for diseases, for medical problems. Now parents are bringing their children to the pediatrician to discuss learning problems, behavior problems, psychological problems, family relationship problems. And Mel Levine, very early in the 1970s, recognized this and said, we have to start training our pediatricians to deal with these developmental and neurodevelopmental issues. And he did that. He started at Harvard and then later moved to North Carolina. But he was one of the first address the training of pediatricians to deal with these kind of educational and developmental problems.
Right.
And that's what pediatricians are doing. When the teacher said your child seems to have an attention problem, that problem ends up in the pediatrician's office.
Right.
That's what's happening to you.
Absolutely. And it's, I guess, because of the nature of society still, when parents and teachers see those kinds of issues, we still go to the medical professionals as opposed to going to mental health specialists and psychologists and counselors and things like that. And hoping, we're hoping that that begins to change because, you know, certainly if you had a cardiac problem, you would go to a cardiologist. If you had allergies problems, you'd go to an ENT. But for some reason, still, when we have emotional or behavioral concerns, we still go to the generalist or the pediatrician or the pediatrician. Primary care. Mm-hmm. And so we need to think about mental health as sort of a specialty as well. But that's, as you said, sort of on the aside. So these six children, with their inattention, with their not fully engaged in the academic process, they end up getting sent to a counselor's office or to someone's office to do an assessment. Now, as each of these six children enter the examination room, the topography of the symptoms, the way that the child presents for all six of these are very similar. They look just alike. They're not paying attention. They're not doing what they need to do. And in fact, for many of these kids, if we did neuropsychological testing, they would come out pretty similar.
The results would be similar. If they have an attention problem, it would show up on the testing.
Right. They would all have some difficulty with planning and organization. Mm-hmm. They would have difficulties with sustained attention.
Staying on task.
They would probably have some difficulty with speeded tasks like rapid naming and word retrieval and things like that.
They would have trouble listening to long reading passages, or long directions, complicated directions.
Right. Mm-hmm. They would be easily distracted, all of those things. And so on the most basic of assessments and examination, these kids, all six of them, would look very, very similar. Mm-hmm. And if we didn't go the next step, just like the six children with coughs, if we didn't go the next step, the problem is we would give all of these kids the same intervention. And depending on the presentation or the orientation of the person examining the student, the intervention that's going to be administered is either going to be effective or not at all
that's
effective.
Right.
And the way that some people present, inexplicably ineffective.
Right.
You know, what happens is when we don't go the next step, we end up implementing an intervention that is irrelevant. It's ineffective, and we would know that it's ineffective. It's sort of like a kid comes in with a headache, and we give them ibuprofen, but the reason for the headache is meningitis. You know, ibuprofen isn't going to do anything to help with the meningitis.
Right.
If a kid comes in with inattention, and we treat it like ADHD, it would be great if that's what was the cause.
That's right.
But if it's for any other number of reasons, it's going to be completely ineffective. And,
that's right.
And again, that's sort of the purpose of the exercise. So,
because in our field, we don't, in the field of psychology and psychiatry, there aren't any lab tests. I mean, you can't do an X-ray, you can't do an MRI, you can't do an EEG. We make our diagnoses based on, number one, observations. What do you see? Number two, test results. But with these six children, they look the same, and their test results are going to be the same. So even if we do the standard assessment of observation or rating scales and test results, even a comprehensive neuropsychological assessment, the results are going to be very similar for these six children.
Right.
So that's not going to get us to the actual cause of why this child has inattention, because it's a three-step process. Number one, you observe something. You observe symptoms. But number two, you have to investigate why this particular child is inattentive, because only in determining that actual cause are you going to get to the effective interventions.
Right.
We've talked about fevers. There's a lot of reasons why kids have fevers.
Right.
You have to treat the real cause. If it's bacterial, you do one thing. If it's viral, you do another thing.
Right.
Headaches, fevers, coughs, doesn't matter. Okay.
Right.
But you have to get to the actual cause. And we have the same obligation in psychology and psychiatry that the physician has with physical problems.
Exactly.
Right? What is the actual cause? Because until you get to the actual cause, you're not going to get the right intervention.
Right. You might get lucky.
That's
you might
right.
get lucky.
You'll be lucky. Well, but how many times do we hear, oh, we've tried medication and it doesn't work?
Right.
Well, of course.
Right.
You could try ibuprofen, but if the child has meningitis, it's not going to work.
Right.
Okay? So there should be no surprise that without an accurate diagnosis, and what do we mean by accurate diagnosis? We mean that we're defining the actual cause.
Right.
Without an accurate diagnosis, we can't possibly, except by luck,
right.
you know, serendipity, we might get it, we might guess right.
Right.
But we want to take the guesswork out of this and do a careful diagnostic workup so that we get to the effective interventions.
Right, right. So let's take our first student.
Okay.
Our first student presents just like all the others, the inattention, the not focusing on task, distractibility, difficulty with sustained attention, difficulty following directions. If you give him four things to do at one time, he's going to maybe do the first one or maybe the last one, but certainly not all four. When you start talking with that student, perhaps you start seeing certain signs that lead you in a particular diagnostic direction. But it won't be until you actually, and this is surprising to some people for some reason, it won't be until you actually start talking to the kid that you start figuring out what's causing his inattention.
Right.
Some kids just can't concentrate. They
right.
can't.
Mm-hmm.
They can't. They don't have the mental energy to focus on something unless it is highly stimulating. So what happens is when we talk to this kid's parent, this kid's parent will likely say, well, he can't, I don't understand, because he sits down and he can't sit for 5 minutes and do his homework without being completely distracted,
right.
but he can sit and play video games for two right. hours at a time.
Right.
And that baffles parents sometimes. Well, in such a presentation, oftentimes, we begin to venture down the path of ADHD. What do we know about ADHD? Well, ADHD is a disorder, as we've talked about in previous podcasts. ADHD is a disorder of executive function that is based upon decreased stimulation in particular regions of the brain. Okay, that's why stimulant medications are prescribed for ADHD. Well, when we start to hear about situations where the kid can provide or can muster up concentration and focus for sustained periods of time, and especially when those situations include things like video games, TV and movies, sometimes sports, when a kid can use or has enough attentional capacity in those settings, again, our immediate thought begins to go to when the situation or when the activity is stimulating enough, when the child's brain is stimulated enough, we may be talking about ADHD.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'd want to go into that direction a little bit more. We'd want to look at that a little bit more to see if ADHD is in fact the cause of or the reason for the inattention in the classroom.
Right, because with ADHD, we're saying we presume that there is an underlying problem that is neurochemical in
right.
origin. I
right.
mean, we assume that. Nobody's ever really documented that. There's no physiology of ADHD. I mean, we assume some things. But we do assume that it's a neurochemical cause.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So that if we're looking at ADHD, we assume a neurochemical cause.
Right.
Okay.
And so our intervention will
be
consistent with that.
Right.
And so
mm-hmm.
the parent then or yeah, if the parent then takes the kid to the pediatrician or to a psychiatrist or something, mm-hmm. the most appropriate treatment in that situation, maybe stimulant medication, especially with this kind of presentation, probably the Adderall or Vyvanse or something like that, to help with stimulating those regions of the brain for better attention.
That's right.
And what we tend to see in those situations is if, in fact, we've made that accurate diagnosis because of investigating it thoroughly, sure, that medication, that situation should work out and we should see an improvement in their attention.
And when we say investigate fully, we mean we've considered all the other possibilities and we've ruled them out.
Right.
The child sleeps okay, the child eats okay, the child does everything else okay. It just looks like this one area of understimulation of those brain regions
seems
to be the cause.
Right.
We've ruled everything else out. So now we think we have a pretty clear explanation of why child one is inattentive.
Right. Now, when child two comes in, we begin the process all over again. We can't say that this is the danger, is that we look at child two and we say, child two looks pretty similar to child one, so let's prescribe Adderall, or let's prescribe a stimulant medication, or let's treat the child as though he has ADHD because he looks just like the last kid that had ADHD.
And it worked with the other kid.
And it worked there.
And he had the same symptoms, so let's treat this kid the same way.
Right. Instead of jumping to that, let's sit down and let's talk to the kid a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And suppose for this child, as we're talking with him, we notice some behavioral things. While the kid is sitting there, he's fidgety. He's wringing his hands. He's talking with some trembling in his voice. He's very hesitant to respond. Just to jump right to it, he's anxious.
Right.
Okay? Mm-hmm. This is a nervous kid.
That's right.
When we talk to him about what's going on in class, he's not inattentive because he's thinking about all these other things that he would rather be doing or anything like that. Mm-hmm. The reason he's inattentive, if he has the capacity to voice this, is he's worried.
Mm-hmm.
What if the teacher calls on me?
Mm-hmm.
What if the teacher has asked me to do something that I don't know what I'm going to do?
Right.
What if when I try to answer this question, I get it wrong? What are the other kids are going to say? What are they going to do? How are they going to pick on me this time?
Right. Or these kids, and I know you've probably seen some, if they take tests, they have to answer every question.
Right.
They can't move on. And they will sit at a spelling test and just stay on number two through the entire test.
Right.
Because they have this need to fill in every line. And if they don't, they stop. It's like they're freezing during the middle of the test.
Right.
The kids who are perfectionistic, who must fill every bubble.
Right.
Okay. So we see those kids all the time.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. And so they can't, the topography is very similar.
Right.
It looks like he's not engaged in tasks.
Mm-hmm.
He forgets things. He's not on task at the time of the things he's supposed to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's because he's lagging behind because he's overthinking.
Right.
Which certainly wasn't the problem for the ADHD kid. But he's overthinking because of his anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
In that situation, for that student, our treatment is going to be incredibly different.
And stimulant medication is not going to treat the anxiety.
And could potentially make it worse.
May make it worse. That's right.
And so in that situation, we have to be very cautious as to how we manage our treatment for the kid.
Right.
In those situations, we often try to avoid giving much medication to a kid who is anxious, especially in third grade, because the medications that we prescribe for anxiety are like SSRIs, and we can, but we don't like giving SSRIs to kids that young.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing with kids with anxiety especially is issues related to sleep.
Right.
And so what we do here is we have to really focus on providing environmental treatment strategies for dealing with his anxiety. So we develop a really strong sleep routine to make sure that the kid gets to sleep. We begin relaxation things. We teach relaxation techniques. We give the teacher things to do to help the student relieve his anxiety. So, you know, if the kid is really anxious that the teacher is going to call on him and he's distracted by this fear that the teacher is going to call on him unexpectedly, we create an agreement between the student and the teacher that says the teacher will not call on you unless she gives you this type of heads up that it's coming so that you can prepare for it. And so that leaves, that helps relieve some of the child's anxiety so that he can then utilize his cognitive facilities to pay attention and to focus and to be actively engaged in the academic process. I keep saying progress instead of process. I don't know why. But again, you can tell that treatment approach is very different than what we would do for ADHD, even though on the surface, the symptoms look very similar. So anxiety, the challenge with anxiety, and even with the next one as we get to that one, the challenge with these situations is you will not typically know unless you talk to the kid. You have to sit down and talk to the kid to understand that stuff, because all of that is going on inside. Those are all internal, inside the kid problems.
Right.
And we often do not know that until we talk to the kid to find out what's going on inside.
Right.
So with child two, again, we're going to probably use more environmental-based interventions and strategies.
Right.
Kid three child comes three. In.
Right.
All right. With child three, again, topography is all the same.
Same concerns.
And what happens, and we're going to, again, follow the same process. We're going to sit down. We're going to talk with the kid. We're going to gather all this information. And again, everything else looks the same. But as we're sitting down and talking with the child this time, perhaps we notice that the child isn't really making eye contact. Mm-hmm. He's looking down. He's not really engaged in the process. He's not really interested in talking all that much. When he does talk, he has what we call a flat affect and flat tone in his voice. There's really no emotional component to his interactions with you. Perhaps we find out that the child, through talking with him, that, you know, sometimes when he's in his room, he's crying. And through this investigation, we find out that this child is depressed. Okay? Again, same inattentive behaviors, same behaviors in the classroom. And what we know from a lot of kids who are depressed is that they aren't as engaged. They are detached. And they avoid interactions with other people, which makes them, again, continue to be disengaged and removed from everyone else. Our treatment here with depression is going to be, again, very, very different than with ADHD or with anxiety.
That's right. There was a long time when we were teaching how to make this diagnosis of ADHD that we would say the medication only works in about 70-75% of children.
Right.
And that means that the other 25-30% of children have something else. And many of them were depressed. And in the 1980s, we didn't even acknowledge depression in children. You remember those years when when we said, no, if you're a child younger than, I think it was 10 or 12, we would say you can't be depressed if you're younger than a certain age. Well, in the 1980s, we learned that, oh, indeed, depression begins much earlier. And in fact, toddlers can begin to show the signs of depression.
Right.
And so we used to say, well, you know, 75% of children with symptoms respond to medication, 25% don't. Maybe they have depression.
Right.
Well, now we know it could be a lot more than just depression.
Exactly. Right? Exactly.
But no, they're not going to. Kids who are depressed, kids who have depression, are not going to typically not going to respond to stimulant medication.
Right.
Not going to work.
Right. And our treatment here, again, you know, we have to be cautious because medication that we would use there, again, includes those antidepressants that we don't like to give kids that young if we don't have to. We could if we needed to, but we don't like to give medications to kids that age. And so we're going to be talking about psychotherapy here. We're going to be talking about having the kid meet with a therapist or someone supportive to talk about what's going on and to explore some of those symptoms and feelings and what's really driving those depressive symptoms. the difficulty with depression with this age group, I mean, we're talking, we said third grade, so we're talking about, you know, eight and nine year old kids. You know, the challenge is that depending on the kid's insight, and this is difficult for people to understand, depending on the kid's insight, he or she may have absolutely no idea why they're depressed, why he's depressed or why she's depressed. They may have no idea. They just know that they feel this way. They just feel sad. They just feel down. They don't feel, they have no motivation. They have no drive.
And they may not even have the language to describe it.
Exactly. You
know, they may not have the words to label the emotion that they're feeling. They know it's something. They don't know. They don't know it's depression.
Right. And when I'm teaching my graduate students, that's how I depict it, because that's, to me, that's the challenge that I enjoy of working with kids, because we can only express our ability to explain things is limited by our vocabulary.
Right.
And if we don't have the terms and the, again, the insight and the understanding of ourselves adequately, we can't express what's really going on. And so it really becomes, for the clinician or the person providing treatment, it really begins to turn into almost an investigation.
Right.
You know, you're trying to investigate what's going on.
That's the right word. The diagnostic workup is an investigation.
Right, right. And that's frustrating for parents, though.
Right.
Because what parents will say, and I hate it when it's this way with medication,
right.
But a lot of times it's trial and error. Okay, let's give this a try.
Right.
Okay, that didn't really work. Let's give that a try. And again, it's more of a problem when we're doing that, or when physicians are doing that with medications. In therapy, it's a little bit easier because we can try different things in a little bit more of a fluid motion. But it's difficult for parents because there's no quick answer. You know, a kid doesn't come in and say, "I'm depressed because of this." Instead, we have to really figure it out. And, you know, to be honest, many people who are depressed are not overly motivated to talk about why they're depressed anyways.
Right.
And so it's
a little bit
of a process to get them to open up and talk to begin with.
Right.
So again, with our third kid, now we've gone through three kids so far. We're halfway through our kids with inattention.
And with this group, we're talking about something that exists within the child.
Right.
These are internal causes.
Right.
Might be depression, might be anxiety. It's something about the child.
Right.
That concerns us, okay? With this second group of three,
right,
we're moving on to
a little bit different things.
Right.
So our fourth kid comes in, and what we're finding out is, by and large, the kid's okay. You know, he presents just like everybody else, but we're not really seeing the depression. Mm-hmm. Not really. Maybe a little bit, but not bad. Not really seeing any anxiety. Maybe a little, but not too bad. No ADHD type things. And so as we go through the initial parts, we may be a little bit puzzled. We may be trying to figure out, okay, what's really going on with this kid? And perhaps if this kid is like a lot of kids we've seen in these kinds of situations, they're hesitant to talk about some things.
Right.
And when we get into it, we find out that his parents have recently separated.
Right.
Okay, he didn't want to talk about it because he's a little bit
embarrassed right.
About it.
Maybe his parents have even said, "Let's not discuss this publicly."
Right,
we're public.
You right,
know, he's not going to come in here and unload on us. He's not. These little children this age don't make those distinctions. They're told not to discuss it with anybody.
Right,
they don't discuss it with us.
And maybe surprisingly to some of you listening, is that those kinds of things come out in maybe session 3 or 4. You know, we go through several sessions with the patient, and even if we meet with the parents, and the parents don't tell us.
I think the most important thing I've learned in my entire education was it takes 3 or 4 sessions to start to get to the real issues.
Right.
You know, you don't get it the first time.
Right. Yeah. And this is definitely an aside, because what the first word that comes to my mind is sucks. What sucks about what
we
have to do?
That on the podcast?
I may have
somebody
to,
go. Who's that guy?
Oh yeah, he was using bad words.
Oh man,
we had to put explicit. But no, what sucks is that we have to give a diagnosis the first day.
That's right.
We have to.
Mm-hmm.
If we're going to bill insurance, we have to.
Right.
And that I think is what is at least in the root of what causes a lot of problems, mm-hmm. is that the first time we see somebody, we have to make a diagnosis. But we know from our experience that oftentimes you have to see somebody two or three, sometimes four or five times, mm-hmm. before you're really starting to get a handle, sure. as to what's going on. Mm-hmm. You know, the physicians and the people who see somebody for 15 minutes and then throw out a diagnosis after 15 minutes, that baffles me. Mm-hmm. And it is exactly the situation that I point to when they say, well, that treatment that they provided didn't work. Yeah, well, that's because you didn't make a good diagnosis.
Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could say, and we talk about this, but a provisional diagnosis.
Right.
You know, this is my hypothesis.
Right.
But it's going to take a couple of sessions, right. to get to the actual, right. diagnosis.
And the problem is that even if we use provisional diagnoses, mm-hmm. which our manual permits.
Right.
Insurance companies don't permit that.
They don't. That's right.
So you have to give a diagnosis. Now, you can change it later. And I talk to patients a lot about that and say, you know, this is the diagnosis I'm going to give for now. So if you see it, that's why. Mm-hmm. But we may change it later on. So, but anyway, so after the third or fourth session, we find out that the kid's parents are separated,
right.
And they're going through a divorce. Well, mm-hmm. as the kid starts opening up, what we start finding out is that while the kid is in class, his thoughts go back to, you know, when am I going to see dad again?
Right.
You know, I miss dad. And he's thinking about the times. It's not really depression. Mm-hmm. Depression, psychopathologically, it's not depression, maybe situational depression. Mm-hmm. But what we're really talking about here is a kid who's just distracted based upon this social, emotional set of circumstances happening in his life.
That's right.
Has nothing to do with true psychopathology.
That's right.
Nothing, and sadly, has nothing to do with what the kid can manage himself.
Right. Yeah, because
he doesn't have any control.
Unlike our first three who had these presumed neurochemical imbalance, these kids don't have any of that.
Right.
You know, there's something outside of them that is creating the same symptoms.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So our treatment here, again, would be therapeutic in mind, but focusing on helping the child develop skills for coping, mm-hmm. with this psychosocial stressor.
Right. Right.
And we're going to develop coping skills. We're going to maybe work with the parents and say, hey, here's some things that you can do to help relieve his stress because, you know, say he's sitting in class and he's often thinking, when am I going to see dad again? Because you really haven't come up with a good visitation schedule yet. Mm-hmm. You know, let's fix that. Mm-hmm. And when we start fixing those things, then we see that the kid, sure. starts to improve.
Or why are my parents divorcing? And is it my fault?
Exactly.
And, you know, did I contribute? Or could I have done anything? Or who's telling me the truth? Which, right. of my parents is telling me the truth about what really happened?
Exactly.
This worries children. And that worry, that external worry, is enough to create the same symptoms.
Exactly.
They look the same.
Exactly.
Very different cause.
Right. So there's our, so that's our, that was our fourth kid, right?
Mm-hmm.
So now let's move to, we have our fifth session of the day. And here comes our fifth child. Again, topography is all the same. Mm-hmm. Inattentive, not paying attention, not actively engaged. As we're talking with this kid, we see some signs maybe of depression.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't look like the same depression that we saw in kid three, but right. there maybe is some depressive stuff there. Some lack of eye contact and some of those kinds of things, but generally speaking, he doesn't look classically depressed. Again, just like with our number four kid, the kids with the parents that are getting divorced, we don't really find out too much the first couple sessions,
mm-hmm.
Because the kid is guarded. And when we think about guardedness, what we're talking about is when we're trying to explore certain parts of the child's life, certain parts of their experience, walls begin to pop up, and the kid is resistant to talking about things and refuses sometimes to talk about things or tries to redirect to something else. And so say perhaps in this kind of situation, it may be even the fifth or sixth or seventh session,
mm-hmm.
that the kid reveals, this student number five reveals that he's being abused. Now, abuse can take lots of forms, physical abuse, sexual abuse, neglect,
Emotional abuse.
Emotional abuse.
Verbal abuse.
There's lots of different forms that abuse can take, and all of them have a different impact on the student.
All of them have an impact.
All of them have an impact.
Right. We need to remember that.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But the impact will vary in degree based upon the frequency, the intensity, the severity, and all of those things. And so what we find is that this kid isn't paying attention in class because he is almost always living his life in crisis mode. Mm-hmm. You know, he doesn't want to do anything to get in trouble in class because as soon as he gets in trouble in class, perhaps he's fearful that he's going to be punished when he gets home.
Right.
And so he's afraid to say or do anything. So we get a little bit of fear in there. And remember from previous podcasts, fear is different than anxiety. Mm-hmm. And so this kid that's being abused, we have a very different approach that we have to take. Now, first of all, if any of us find out that a kid is being abused, we have to report it.
Right. And that's the reason they don't tell us.
Right.
Because these kids, like the child of divorce, frequently they're told, don't tell anybody, otherwise DCF is going to come and take you out of the house.
They're going to remove you. They're going to take you away from us.
And put you with strangers.
Right.
Take you away from us and put you with strangers. So under no circumstances should you ever discuss this with anybody.
Right, right. Yeah. And again, the dynamics of this are infinite. Mm-hmm. There's so many different ways that this manifests in different homes. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line is that the kid is unable to attend because he's in survival mode.
Well, I think of young girls, young girls or young boys. We typically think of girls who are being abused by a relative or a friend. You know, we typically think of all kids going home to a very stable nuclear family. Well, in fact, large numbers of children are going into very unstable homes with people coming in, relatives coming in,
right.
Step siblings coming in, older siblings. And there are many children in the country who are being consistently sexually abused. It's not ritualistically right. sexually. It's not like on occasion or it happens one
right.
time. There are kids in our public schools who are going home every day, and this event is going to occur at some point.
Right.
Okay? Imagine if you're 8 or 9 years old and you're sitting in a classroom trying to think about a reading assignment when you know 3 or 4 hours from now you're going to be exposed to that horror, that recurring horror.
Right. You're hoping that mom will be home when you get there, because when mom's home, it's
there's
safe.
Less of, right.
But when
right.
mom's not home, when mm-hmm. if dad or stepdad or whoever
Uncle,
sends right. mom away to get right. something from the grocery store, you know mm-hmm. that's when the risk happens.
Right.
And what we're talking about, you know, this goes back to Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
Right.
You know,
right.
the mm-hmm. if you haven't seen his triangle of needs, mm-hmm. you know, the bottom is safety.
Safety.
You have
survival
to feel safe.
And safety.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm. And these kids are on that basic level. Mm-hmm. Everything else, learning.
It's way up on the hierarchy.
You have to be pretty secure.
That's right.
Before you can get to a point where you're capable of attending and learning.
Right.
And this is what blows my mind with kids who... well, we're not going to get into testing today, but we've talked about it before that, you know, when we talk about the various issues or variables that can affect a child's test performance, this is one. If a kid isn't safe, he's or she is not going to get much from the academic setting.
Mm-hmm. No matter what the academic setting looks like.
No matter what.
Doesn't matter who the teacher is. Doesn't matter what the curriculum is. Doesn't matter what the textbook is. It doesn't matter for children if they're functioning at that lowest level of Maslow's needs hierarchy.
Right.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. So our treatment here, again, is going to be very different. First of all, we have to make the phone call, the dreaded phone call. Because, the truth is that while DCF needs to be involved in those situations, DCF's involvement creates additional stressors.
Right.
It creates a new set of challenges.
It solves one problem.
Right. But introduces
but
more.
But it creates another.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So this is another therapeutic session, a therapeutic situation where we have to work with the patient, and we have to work with the kid to help them understand what's happened, help them cope and feel safe. That's sort of the goal mm-hmm. of treatment here would be to help the kid
that's
feel
right.
safe.
That's right.
Again, that's different than the therapy we give for anxiety, different mm-hmm. than the therapy we give with depression, right. different with the therapy we give when parents are getting divorced. Right. The therapy here is to help the child feel safe mm-hmm. And secure in who they are. Because what we also know will happen is that the child will be removed, but despite the abuse, one of the child's goals will be to get back home. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Despite the fact that the predator right. may still be there, the abuser may still be there, mm-hmm. the child's going to want to go back
she
home.
Wants to be with her parents. Right?
And so we have to, you know, we have to focus our therapy on that. Again, very, very different treatment.
That's right.
Jumping back from the beginning, stimulant medication would do nothing for the situation.
No matter what we do with this child, if she doesn't feel safe, it doesn't matter how much medication we use, it doesn't matter what other treatment, if she doesn't feel safe, the symptoms are not going to go away.
Right. Exactly. So again, different treatment, different reason for inattention. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. And so now we move on to our last kid, child number six.
Okay.
Now, child number six presents a little bit differently still. This kid on the surface seems mm-hmm. perfectly fine.
Right. Yeah. In most other places, he does okay. You know, yeah. he's in scouts and he's in sports and he's got siblings, and this really isn't, inattention really isn't a concern anywhere else. It seems
right.
to be mainly at school and homework.
And homework.
Right.
And in fact, unlike all of the other kids, if we did neuropsychological testing with him, he will probably come out in the average range for everything.
That's right.
He'll look just fine.
These three kids who have
these
external factors impinging on them, they may come out a little bit different on neuropsychological. They may not, because
right.
you know, there's still something going on. But it's likely that these kids are going to be testing in the normal or near normal range
yeah.
on those same measures.
Right.
Right.
So this kid on testing will likely look just fine.
Right.
When you're talking to him, likely mm-hmm. looks just fine.
Right.
The problem here is that despite him being just fine, this kid is just fine compared to what's expected for a kid his age.
Mm-hmm.
He's compared to other 8-year-olds, he's commensurate. He's
right.
at age level.
Mm-hmm.
He looks just fine. The problem here, as we continue to do our investigation, and what we find here is that our this is where it's important to have a broad net
mm-hmm.
when we do our investigation, our diagnostic investigation. And what we find here is that the child happens to go to a school where in third grade, the curriculum that he's learning from is really at a fifth grade level.
That's right.
Okay? So the issue here isn't really within the child at all. The issue here is really a systemic problem. And what I like to call this a curriculum disorder.
Right.
Because what we really have a problem with here is that the expectations placed upon the child far exceeds his developmentally appropriate
mm-hmm.
Ability.
Right.
Now, that's not to say that there's other kids in his class that are the same age as him that do just fine,
mm-hmm.
because they may
do.
Be.
Right.
But this kid, despite being within the average range on all measures that we would think of as it relates to academics and cognitive skills, this kid can't manage that curriculum. And so, just like anyone that's listening to this podcast, if we started to do a discussion on molecular genetics, now unless you're a molecular genetics expert or you're in school for that, if we began to do a talk about molecular genetics, it would not be very long before you turn the podcast off.
Right.
Because you're not going to be really paying attention. You're going to tune out. And you're going to be like, I don't even know why I have this on.
Right.
It's just noise now.
Right.
And that's the description that kids give when the curriculum is far, far exceeds their ability.
It
right. just becomes noise because they can't keep up with it. The teacher's using words that they don't understand. They're talking about concepts that the kid hasn't yet mastered. And they're moving at a pace that the kid just can't keep up with.
Right. And for adults, just imagine that you're sitting in a class, and as you just said, either a topic that you have no background knowledge in, so you don't understand, so you tune out. Or it's presented in a foreign language that you don't understand.
Right.
You're going to lose interest.
Gonna.
Okay. And that's the best analogy, I think. Imagine that you're listening to a lecture in some language that you don't understand.
Yeah.
That's exactly how these kids are functioning.
Right. And so it's not surprising that the kid, you know, he's inattentive in class.
Going to lose interest.
He's behind. Mm-hmm. He's thinking about something else. And what is he thinking about? When you talk to him, he's thinking about things that he enjoys. Why wouldn't he? You know, he's thinking about, man, I would really like to be home playing video games right now.
He's going
to
be thinking about his interests.
Right.
What is he interested in? That's what he's going to be thinking about.
Yeah, yeah. So this particular student, although he has the capacity, the developmentally appropriate capacity, he's being taught or he's being placed in a developmentally inappropriate environment.
Right.
And that is the source of his inattention. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Treatment here really has nothing to do with the kid.
Right.
What we have to do here is we really have to change the curriculum. We have to change the expectations of the classroom or move him to a classroom that's more developmentally appropriate.
Get him into an environment where he can function.
Right. We see this a lot in situations where kids are in some private schools. But also, especially when kids are in some magnet and charter schools, where the curriculum is just accelerated enough that it sort of pushes beyond their scope of ability, and they're just not able to manage it.
That's right. The curriculum and the pace
right.
is just a little bit beyond. You know, we teach Lev Vygotsky.
Right.
And he talks about the zone of proximal development,
yeah.
you know, where a child can learn with a little bit of assistance. Some of these classrooms are way beyond some children's zone of proximal development.
Right.
And they just can't handle it, even with support.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so we medicate and we punish. And that's what's sad, is that we start to do interventions as though there's something wrong with the child.
Right.
There's nothing wrong with the child. It's the mismatch between the child and the curriculum.
Right. And the sad thing is, and to me this is sad, because this makes the kids crazy, is we say, even if we say, okay, this is a curriculum problem, so here's how we're going to correct this problem.
Right.
We're going to put the kid in 2 hours of tutoring every day.
Right.
Okay, so that means that the kid is going to be in school for 7.5 hours. He's mm-hmm. going to get up at 7, be at school by 8, get out of school by 3 or so, mm-hmm. and then he's going to go to tutoring for a couple of hours.
Right.
I mean, okay, we should be paying the kid overtime.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's working more than we work in a typical day.
Time and a half.
Mm-hmm. And then we're expecting, well, and I've heard this from parents and teachers and things. Well, you know, he's just not working hard enough in tutoring.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what are you expecting from this guy? You know, he's in there for 7.5 hours a day
right.
in an environment that he what many of these kids say, he's working as hard as he can to try to pay attention.
Mm-hmm.
So these kids are often exhausted by the end of the day because they're putting forth so much mental energy to attempt to pay attention, even though they're not doing a very good job.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're punishing him by making him do it for 2 more hours.
Right.
And then we're surprised that he's not eager to go to school the next day. We're surprised that he is frustrated with his situation. We're surprised that he's not able to pay attention in school. Again, it's... When we look at the cause, if we look at the why are these symptoms happening, mm-hmm. we will definitely be shifting mm-hmm. our approach. And
right.
in this situation, we have to deal with the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
This really doesn't have anything to do with the kid. We have to change the classroom, fix the expectations there.
Mm-hmm.
And if we do that, we tend to see the kid do better.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And we used third grade for this example, because it's in third grade that all of these different kids that we've been talking about this morning, that's when all of these issues begin to really emerge. We really start to see these issues take form
right.
and take hold in third grade.
After third grade, right.
My concern is for this sixth child, this kid with the curriculum issue,
mm-hmm.
is if we don't respond appropriately, if we don't recognize that this is a school-based, a classroom-based, a curriculum-based problem, and we place the blame on the kid, what we're going to do very, very quickly is we're going to squash his hunger for learning. And we see that in kids who have been beat down because, well, you just need to pay attention better. You just need to do this. Well, let's give you this medication, and that medication ends up not working. And let's try this medication, and that medication is not working. And we keep trying these different things because we know there's got to be something wrong with you that's making this happen. By the time these kids are finishing up elementary school and entering middle school, they hate school.
Mm-hmm. You know, this, and it brings to mind this notion of involuntary deviance, because right. in each of these six cases, none of these children have asked for any of this.
Right.
The first three children have some sort of chemical difference. You know,
psychopathology.
It's not a problem. It's a different. Their brains are structured or function differently than they're supposed to. But they just do. No kid, no child asks for that.
Right. Okay?
And the second three, all of these problems are completely beyond the child's ability. These are external factors
right.
that really have nothing. The child is not responsible for anything.
Right.
The child didn't ask for the divorce. The child didn't ask for the curriculum. The child didn't ask to be abused.
Right.
Okay? So these are external factors beyond their control. And yet, invariably, when a child isn't doing well in school, we blame the child. There's
right.
something about the child. And what's one of the first things we reach for? She's lazy.
Right.
You know, that we hear right. that. Freak, she's lazy.
Yeah.
She's just not paying attention. She's not motivated. She's this, she's that. The first request I think that I'd like to make is that when you have a child who begins to bump up against their environment, they begin to struggle against teachers or with others, the first thing to do is not blame the child, but take that step back and say, what's causing it? What is the actual cause of this? And
right.
I think you'll discover that in the first case, there's a chemical imbalance of some sort, a chemical difference, structural functional difference in the brain. In the second case, there's some external factor
right.
that's causing this child to bump against the his or her environment.
Right. Rarely.
Don't start with the child's lazy.
Right. Rarely is it willful.
No, 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 no kid wants to battle every day with their,
right.
with the people they encounter.
What fun is that?
Parents, teachers, why would you get up and want to battle every single day?
Right.
It's not that those children don't exist, but there really aren't very many of them.
Right. So the take home, hopefully today, mm-hmm. is, you know, when you see problems, either in your child, in one of the students in your classroom, a patient that you're working with, if you're a clinician, a kid in your family, when you see some of these issues, let's be cautious about how quickly we jump to assuming what the problem is.
That's right.
And taking a one-size-fits-all type of approach to dealing with it. Because when we do that, we find that sometimes we're lucky,
mm-hmm.
But oftentimes we fall short, and then we find that as yet another reason, usually, to blame the child as being the problem, that they're just not working hard enough. They're
right.
not doing the things that they need to do. And so we need to be cautious of that so that we can provide the most appropriate diagnosis, the most appropriate understanding of why something's happening, and then provide the right diagnosis
right.
and right treatment.
Take the time to figure out what really is going on, what the real cause is,
right.
and you'll be very close to the right intervention.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So if you have any thoughts or any questions about this, we'd love to hear from you. You can write to us on our Facebook page. The Mental Breakdown has a Facebook page. Facebook, I think it's facebook.com/Dr. Bernie. I think that when I made it so long ago, the Mental Breakdown wasn't available, so mm-hmm. I had to go to Dr. Bernie. So it's facebook.com/Dr. Bernie, B-E-R-N-E-Y. Or you can just type in the Mental Breakdown and it typically comes up.
Okay.
You can follow us on Twitter, at Dr. Bernie is the handle there. That would be a great way to get in touch with us. We post stuff all the time, articles that we find, things that we think about. We get that out there as often as we can. A quick announcement on December 11th.
Yes.
So next Friday, a week from today.
Right.
The podcast will probably be a little bit delayed only because we're doing a workshop that day. Mm-hmm. Our workshop is called Managing the Holidays. It's going to be a 3-hour workshop in Bartow. If you live here in the Lakeland, Polk County area, in Central Florida. So check our website, PACFlorida, PACFLORIDA.com, and click on the workshops tab and you can register there. We can If you register for it, you can get CEUs. If you're a licensed mental health counselor, licensed clinical social worker, or licensed marriage and family therapist, we get 3 CEUs for that. We can also give documentation and everything for teachers to try to get in service from their principals. So check that out. Follow us on these different forms of social media. There's always something going on. We love talking to you and hearing from you. Lastly, if you listen to us on iTunes, or if you had the opportunity, jump over on iTunes, and if you could write us a review or rate us, that would be fantastic. That's how other people find us. I tell you, based upon ratings and everything, I find a lot of new podcasts, and I really enjoy listening to them, but as I go in and kind of look at them a little bit more, they have lots of comments, and that's why they came up, so that I could find them. So if you get the chance, jump on and write us a review, rate us, and that way other people can find us. Mm-hmm. All right. So let us hear from you. We're doing a survey on our website. So if you go to The Mental Breakdown on Facebook, you'll see that. I'd love to hear from you for that. So
keep the conversations going.
Right. So until next week, I'm Dr. Bernie.
And I'm Dr. Richard.
And have a great week, and we'll talk to you later. Bye-bye.